Hey, check this out. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one with the Grand Verbalizer.
Funkin' Lesson Brother J, the X-Clan.
That's right, so keep it locked, Hard Knock Radio.
One love.
This is Jim Brown, number 32 from the Cleveland Browns on Hard Knock Radio.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King on Hard Knock Radio. Tune in and listen, babies.
This is Michael Eric Dyson. When I'm in the Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco area, and I want to hear the real deal, I listen to Hard Knock Radio with my man, Davey D. You heard?
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. It is Hard Knock Radio, and welcome back to the new year as we kick off 2013. We are back in full effect, and I wanted to start things off with an interesting article that appeared in Alternet this morning, and it was written by the author of a dozen or so books. One of them is called, and let me make sure I get the full title because it's an intriguing one. It is called Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Founded the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All or Almost All of It Back. We're talking with author Frank Schaefer, and he's written an article called America's White Male Problem. And so welcome to the show, Frank. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm fine.
I mean, just the title of your article and the title of your book, we could probably have full discussions on.
Right, right.
Let's start off with the article, America's White Male Problem. A lot of people will say this in passing, but they don't always get into a deep analysis as to what do you really mean when you say there's a white male problem. And so maybe you could break this down, because you talk about it being something more than just a political ideology that is being held by certain members of our government.
Right. Well, you know, going back to the book Crazy for God, I have to set it up by saying, look, I'm 60 years old. I'm a father and grandfather. I live in the Northeast, but I come from a conservative religious evangelical background. In fact, in the 1970s and 80s, I was hanging out with people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, the guys that started Focus on the Family. My family knew the Bush family, the Reagans, the Ford family. In fact, one of the Ford kids was babysitting my daughter when she was just born, when her dad became president, et cetera, et cetera. I come from a white, evangelical, right-wing background, and that's the basis of this article. Since then, I have changed my opinion, as I talk about in the book. And, for instance, for the last number of years, I've been one of Huffington Post's lead bloggers. I was one of the early supporters of Barack Obama for president. I've hung in there with him all through it. I think he's a great president. So that kind of just fills in the journey I've taken. Now, from that perspective, in the article in Alternet, I'm looking at the fact that these white Republicans, principally from the South, principally from states where, if you look at the map, they're former slaveholding states, have carried forward a kind of a culture war agenda that is tinged with racism and xenophobia, and I think basic psychological inability to deal with the fact that our country has changed. Whites are no longer going to be the majority here. We have a black American president who is smarter than most of his critics, if not all of them. He's not angry. He has cut against the stereotype of the black male that the white right has always liked to hold up as dangerous. He's moderate, soft-spoken, and I think we really look at people who are psychologically unbalanced in Congress today, representing not all Republicans by any means, or all Southerners by any means, or all whites by any means, but a group of people who have truly been unhinged by the demographic direction of our country. They just can't deal with what's happened to America. And you see that very clearly in the rise of these secessionist movements. You see it very clearly in the gun rights movement, that if you really peel away all the rhetoric, you know, when it gets to people who want 30 round clips of cop killing Kevlar busting ammo in semi-automatic weapons, they're not interested in hunting or home defense. What they're doing is basically making a political statement saying we read the Second Amendment as our right to so-called Second Amendment remedies against our own federal government, and they feel threatened. So wherever you look at what I'll call the white underclass, even if they happen to be congressmen and senators, who just can't deal with the demographic shifts in America away from a monopoly of white power, you have an attitude that says, hey, we'd rather shut down the government, destroy the good faith and credit of the United States, than work with our first black American president. And that's really what the heart of the Tea Party opposition to Barack Obama has boiled down to. And I think a lot of the issues that get discussed, as I talk about in the alternate article, are just a smokescreen. They're a smokescreen for a psychological problem that can't deal with this country as it's evolving. And so you see these guys using words like we have to take back America. Well, for whom? From whom? Well, from the rest of us who don't see it their way. From black people, brown people, Hispanic people, a lot of women, people in South and North who have moved on and who believe in everything from gay rights to affirmative action. They want to take back the country from these folks. And so you see this pathology expressed in a lot of ways, and that's what my alternate piece that's their headline this morning is all about. And I just think it's time that the mainstream media stop playing games and treating all these issues these folks raise as substantive and cut to the chase and just say, hey, what is your problem with Barack Obama? No, no, not the problems you talk about. What is your real problem with this president? Why have you tried to obstruct his whole presidency from the beginning? Why do you lack all patriotism and commitment to our own government and our own way of life? And you're ready to destroy the faith and credit of the United States and our economy in a kind of a scorched earth policy to stop this man from doing anything. That's the problem. So I'm not talking about all Republicans or all people who disagree with Obama. There's plenty on the left who do for other reasons. I'm talking about a nugget, an obdurate, stubborn nugget of people who came out of the Tea Party movement, who have entrenched themselves and have virtually, as I put it in the article, hijacked our government. They don't have the ability to do anything positive. Their only ability is that they have worked hard to stop anybody from getting anything else done.
If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of author Frank Schaefer. You know, I hear what you're saying, and one of the things that comes to mind is the idea. Well, two things come to mind. First, is it really a racial thing, or is this the thing of trying to find an angle to latch on to maintain power? And I ask this understanding that if it was maybe a Hillary Clinton, would we have seen the same type of approach? One might argue that we saw this with Bill Clinton when he was president, that they pulled out all the stops and tried to find ways to one-up him. So is it a racial thing, as you describe in your article, or is it really a thing of this is the angle that we can ride on, we'll take it, and we'll take it all the way to the bank?
I think it's all of the above. But I think that the media shies away from the racial angle. They just don't want to talk about it. So I think all those other elements are there. And I think if it was any Democratic president with Obama's policies, you would get resistance. But what you would not have gotten is the insanity on the fringe becoming mainstream. What do I mean by that? Of course, there's always nutcases. There's John Birchers, there's racists, there's Ku Klux Klan guys, there's secessionists. You know, we live in a big country, and there's all kinds of people hovering around the edges. What's amazing over the last 4 years has been that some of these fringe opinions held by people like Glenn Beck suddenly become mainstream. Fox News gives them a show. People who want to oppose the health care reform suddenly get mainstream media attention claiming there'll be death panels, and no one just laughs them out of court in the early part of the discussion. You know, the birther thing was for real. 30% of Americans said they didn't believe that the president was a real American. You know, over half of Republicans. You know, a third of Republicans polled in New Jersey, and this is an East Coast, you know, non-Bible belt state, described Obama literally as the Antichrist. People talk about him being a Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. When you get to those fringe elements, it's not surprising that they're there. What surprises me is that the elected officials in Congress have not denounced them and read this crazy right-wing paranoid delusional fringe out of their movement in the same way that, for instance, my old friend William F. Buckley, who started the National Review magazine and who I knew well when I was a kid because he was a friend of my father's, denounced the John Birch Society and their crazy conspiracy theories about Eisenhower. So I think what's shocking is not the views of the fringe. It's how mainstream those views have become to the actual Republican Party, either really or at least through the silence of those who have been elected to office, not routinely denouncing them and saying, look, these people don't represent us. That silence, in a way, has been more shocking over the last 4 years than anything the crazy people on the edge have said. So I think, yes, you're right. The opposition would be fierce to a Democratic president. But the ante has been upped by the fact he's black. And then I think part of it is not just straight racism aimed at Obama. I think it's this fear, this psychological unhinging of white men, particularly white men who come from a certain type of background, who grew up being used to the idea that people like them, people who looked like them, people who thought like them, evangelical right-wing Christian people thinking in that way, would always be in charge. And so I think when the NRA, for instance, has consistently lied about the president and said if he's elected, he'll take all our guns away and stir to the pot politically on that kind of thing, the people they're appealing to are real xenophobes who sit there literally clutching, you know, semi-automatic weapons, who stockpile thousands of rounds of ammunition, who march around in the woods playing soldier with their friends and call it militias, etc. That fringe element has grown during the presidency of Barack Obama, and the shocking thing is it has not been denounced by what we would call responsible office holders who either share those views or at least remain so silent that it seems they do.
Right.
And that's been my problem with it. So I don't see blanket racism as explaining everything. I see it as part of the mix. What I think has happened, though, is that this fear of the changing demographic, whether it's women suddenly having positions of power, whether it's gay people finding their full voice in civil rights, whether it's African Americans suddenly in positions of power, including the presidency, this has really unhinged a group of white males in this country, the kind of people who are in those militias and the secessionist movement on one hand, but literally they're now in Congress. They aren't the majority. They aren't everybody. It isn't most people. But I think if you took the 30 or 40 leading Republican white voices in Congress who oppose everything this president does, you'd really have to put them on a psychiatrist's couch before you'd find the real reasons, because they sure aren't political, because it's making the party look terrible.
Right. When you look at history, one of the things that we noticed is that the aristocracy, the so-called 1% that existed in the past, maybe under a different name, would play the masses of people off one another. And so to kind of condense it, you have the indentured servant on the same plantation with the African person who is enslaved, noticing that there could be a majority of people willing to change their conditions if they came together, would have the people power to overthrow, you empower the indentured servants, make them less than the aristocracy, but better than the quote-unquote African slave, and you kind of pit these two groups against one another. I'm bringing this up to ask in using and having you to look into your background as an evangelical and somebody who's come from those places. Do these folks know that they're being used by a higher power, or is this something that they're doing independent of the type of manipulation that I'm saying exists? And let me just kind of close that out by saying that one of the criticisms that people have had about just what is going on in government, whether it's Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, or whoever's in office, is that it's become beholden to corporations, and we have a corporatocracy that exists. And so in order to maintain that sort of dominance, it would work to their advantage to have a growing black and brown population being pitted against evangelicals, poor whites, and folks who have some of the tendencies that you described. Is there any sort of connection to that sort of perspective?
Well, I think very much so. And you see it literally in a couple of areas. Let's just start with an obvious one. The NRA is nothing except a paid lobbying group for the gun manufacturers who have made billions of dollars off this type of paranoia. And you see a direct connection with stirring up white fear of on racial issues, whether it's somebody's going to crash through your door, you know, next time you hear the sound of breaking glass, you know, grab your gun. But then also this whole trumped up anti-Obama NRA agenda where they have said, you know, if he gets reelected, he'll take away your guns. As soon as he's reelected, arm sales jump by 50 to 100% in some areas of the country. Stores sell out of ammunition. These are psychological breakdowns people are having because obviously they bear no relationship to the truth whatsoever. And it's a deliberate corporate manipulation of an underclass of often not very well educated, if educated at all, people who thrive on misinformation coming from folks like Fox News 24/7 and people even to the right of them. That's a very clear instance, a less clearly provable instance, but one that is just as damaging, if not more so, is what you see with people like the Koch brothers and the other manipulators of the far right, who, when it comes to what they would regard as the rube white underclass, I'm saying they would regard them as this, not me. Mm-hmm. They would not let these guys caddy for them on their private golf course or inside the gates of their gated communities. They would look at these fellows as with total disdain, but as very, very useful to their cause in that they stir up the social problems I talk about in my book, Crazy for God. I lay this out. I say, look, things like the pro-life movement, the anti-gay movement have been used by evangelical empire builders for fundraising purposes and power base, but they in turn have been used by corporate America because, look, it's hard to get people to vote against their own interests. So if the white underclass was approached by people like the Koch brothers saying, look, we want to pay zero taxes on most of our income. You bear the burden, and meanwhile, we'll sell you a product that's destroying the planet. That would not fly. But if you come to them and say, hey, we're all about saving babies and preserving your right to bear arms, get them at the social issue weak spots that don't really cost corporate America anything, but keep people in line and keep them voting against their own interests, it's very useful. And so it's no accident that folks like the Koch brothers have underwritten with tens of millions of dollars, not just Republican candidates, but groups like the Tea Party, all these think tanks on the fringe that keep feeding them their own version of facts and so forth. And yeah, of course there's a relationship. And of course the people who are making money, who are seeking power in office, folks like Karl Rove, have spent years both manipulating these people, but at the same time, I think, quietly disdaining them.
Right.
And now they're very worried because they, quote-unquote, this unwashed mob, have produced actual leaders in Congress, a.k.a. the Tea Party, folks who got elected, the 87 freshman congressmen, of which about 30 are hardcore activists and ideologues. And now they've just lost a national election because the country can't stomach this. And
right.
So now they're facing the destruction of the Republican Party based on the fact that they got what they wanted. They got what they wished for. They energized the paranoid white underclass, and they sent actual candidates to Washington who sincerely believe this stuff and will not compromise, even if it means our faith and credit worldwide or our economy smashes.
Right.
And they're willing to do it. These are hostage takers, not politicians.
We're talking with Frank Schaefer. He's the writer and author of the book Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, helped found the religious right and lived to take all or almost all of it back. He's also the author of an insightful article that appears on Alternate called America's White Male Problem. You know, Frank, I've done a lot of work in Texas, and in fact, I'm just getting back from there. And that is pretty much a ground zero type of place in terms of a lot of the politics that we see that have been in many people's opinion, very extremist. That's been a ground zero place where
right.
a lot of that has come out of. But my work there has also unveiled something else. Right now we've been talking in terms of right and left, Democrat, Republican. But I found from my own experience that some of the obstacles that were also tossed in the way came from fellow Democrats who were unwilling to share seats at the table with
right.
black and brown and a more diverse population. And I want to know how you kind of seen that, especially coming from that sort of background. Is it really a left-right thing, or do we just have some people who, even if they're Democrat in this case, would go against their interests. In other words, I would rather deal with the Tea Party than share some of this power.
Right. Well,
with
I think
black or
been...
brown, you know, person.
Yeah. Well, there's been a constant in American politics. Again, we don't like to talk about this. It's not polite. Who wants to wash their dirty laundry? But let's be honest. You know, it was the party of Lincoln, the Republicans, that were associated first with the empowerment of our black population. Then they switch sides, and all of a sudden the Republicans play the race card in the South, and they become the party of the xenophobic Southern white vote. Back in the Nixon era, that used this deliberately with Charles Colson as a tactic. Now, you know, you have a mixture. But what remains constant is the fact that America has a racist past and present, and to some extent a future. It's not going to be quick. And I think you see this even in liberal circles where there's a blindness. For instance, I'll just tell you something personal. I've recently been kind of shocked by the fact that there's one of the number one New York Times bestsellers has been a very laudatory portrait of Thomas Jefferson. Now, Thomas Jefferson, you know, wrote our Declaration of Independence. He was not just a slaveholder, but when other people like George Washington were releasing his slaves, Jefferson hung on to them because he liked the good life and he couldn't afford the French red wine he had imported yearly in a huge shipment from France after being there. He had, the first time he had sex with his slave mistress, she was 14 years old. Well, today that would be rape and he would have been put away for life. Yet, you know, if you read that book or you hear the author on a talk show, people will say, well, what about the dark side of Jefferson's career, the downside? And he'll make some answer to the effect, well, you know, we can't judge the past by the present standards. These are exceptions to an otherwise wonderful career that was so important to America. And all I have to say is this, look, If we take that standard and we say that as many people died in the slave trade crossing the Atlantic, being rounded up and sold over here, et cetera, et cetera, at least half the number died in that Holocaust as died in the Holocaust against the Jews in Germany. And yet, you know, you don't see biographies of Hitler saying, well, you know, he had this blind spot, but we can't judge the past by the present standards. Let's not be moralistic here. Let's look at the great things he did. He founded Volkswagen. He built the autobahns. He made Germany run on time. He restored German pride after the Versailles Treaty with France that had so diminished them. Let's look at this in a balanced way. You just don't get that because it's out of the question. It's not acceptable. And yet it is acceptable to talk about a slaveholding rapist who did not free any of his slaves until he freed posthumously his six black children, the ones he acknowledged anyway, when he died, who sold families and split them apart to punish some of the slaves on his farm he didn't like, we can say that's a blind spot. So as long as America has this kind of dual approach to morality, where if you murder 6 million Jews, it's a sin for which you can't be forgiven, and you can never be elevated in history to hagiographies and wonderful biographies. But if you are part of a machinery that grinds up the lives and kills 3 million black people in transit, enslaves them, beats them, sells their families down the river, rapes their daughters, bears children that you don't even free during your lifetime, oh, you can still be one of the great founding fathers. So I just put that to you.
Right.
You know, this is a famous liberal author, former editor of Newsweek, who is a regular commentator on MSNBC, as I'm often on as well, that same program on various news shows. And yet nobody sits there and says, hey, haven't we passed the point where Thomas Jefferson can be looked at in heroic terms no matter what he did, because the downside of this man's life, even judged by the spirit of the times, where people like Washington were urging him to release his slaves and he wouldn't. So it's not even looking back with clarity. There were people in his own day and age who saw it in clarity. This is the guy who pushed the slave trade into the Western states. This is the guy who gave us this. Let's just stop this double-dealing nonsense where we see monumental evil in other people's histories but will not admit that there is something rotten at the core of this country that's only now just starting to be fixed. Let's begin there. And that's the light in which we should be looking at the presidency of our first African American. On one hand, as a tremendous triumph for the white population that voted for him as well as other people. But on the other hand, let's not pretend that in a nation which can make a number one New York Times bestseller out of a book, a laudatory book of a slaveholding rapist, at the same time, that is the world our African-American president is functioning in. And let's not kid ourselves. And that's what I'm saying in the article. And that's what I just personally deeply, deeply, deeply believe. As I say, a 60-year-old white guy, father and grandfather, who used to be on the other side. Not that I ever have been a racist in that sense, but I was part and parcel of the religious right that basically never wanted to talk about these attitudes, let alone admit them.
Right. As we close out, Frank, Lee Atwater was a key architect. Did you know him? And what sort of strategies did he employ that you might have used, or vice versa, when you were, you know, doing your
sure.
thing amongst the religious right?
Well, I didn't know Lee Atwater, but I knew people who knew him. And the people I knew well were like Dick Armey, for instance, who's still around helping spearhead the whole Tea Party. And of course, Jack Kemp was a personal friend, and I stayed in his home quite often. And the technique was very simple. And that was, you went to white evangelicals or conservative blue-collar Roman Catholics in Pennsylvania, and you said, vote for us because we're going to support fill in the blank, pro-life issues or anti-gay rights issues, whatever it was, get prayer back in school. And it was like a sleight of hand. It was like a guy on the street corner playing card tricks on people and cheating them. You know, we'll show you this card here of an aborted baby, and then shuffle, shuffle, shuffle under the little shells here. Pull it up. Where is it? Well, all of a sudden it disappears. And what it's really about is lowering corporate taxes for Wall Street. So Jack Kemp knew we were doing that. Dick Armey has played that game all along and become a millionaire, running all kinds of companies and think tanks and foundations, et cetera, pushing this and using it for lobbying. And, you know, I knew Dick, I knew Jack, I knew a lot of these guys. I knew Charles Colson, who had worked for Nixon and done the same thing. And it was always the same story. Show them an issue they care about, and then, having baited them, switch it. And when you get elected, what it's all about is corporate profits.
That's real talk right there. You know, lastly, one of the challenges that has come up with Barack Obama is, one, he has a lot of criticism on the left, especially in an area where we're broadcasting. And one of the things that has been put forth is that if you put a black or brown face, to a country that is imperialistic by nature, in other words, we're in Africa, there's a lot of militarization that has gone on in some of those countries. And when we have people that are from some of these countries, he's not seen as favorable as we might think. How do we kind of reconcile that while this black president is being attacked by xenophobes and racists, there is a natural tendency, of course, to circle the wagon and hold them down. But at the same point, how do we reconcile that some of the policies are problematic if they are not just, or if they seem to be something that would be like, wow, if a white president was in Africa setting up AFRICOM, we would be in the streets right now. Mm-hmm. Black president does it, we're going to give him a pass because he's being attacked by the Tea Party. How do
right.
you kind of parse that out?
Well, you know, I am a supporter of Barack Obama, and unashamedly so. I think he's a great president. And I think that given what he's had to do when coming into office, first of all, the economic situation he was served with, the two wars he inherited that were not of his making, and the bitter, insane, I'll use that word advisedly, insane level of opposition and obstruction he's faced. It's amazing that our economy's coming back. It's amazing that he wound these wars down and is winding the last one down. It's amazing that any achievements have been made in the area of gay rights or civil rights or women or anything else. And so I think we just have to get real in terms of the perspective of history. So first of all, there's plenty with this president to disagree with policy on, just like you would with anybody. I have huge questions about all these drone strikes, for instance. And I'm the father of a young man that served in the Marine Corps and fought in Afghanistan in the first wave of Marines that went in. But I'm not some blind flag-waving patriot. I think it's terrible that we're using, you know, assassination from the sky as a point of policy. And it's just we're stuck in a terrible cycle of violence and exporting, you know, this kind of colonial, neo-colonial overreach. I think it's a disaster. But that's not Barack Obama's sole disaster. That's the whole direction of American policy ever since the Second World War ended. And we all know that who have looked at it or studied it. But in terms of Barack Obama's presidency, first of all, we're only at the dawn of the second term. Secondly, given the obstruction he's faced, I just think it's a sensational list of achievement against just astronomical odds that, again, none of us really want to admit how tall the odds have been, because it takes really being willing to look at the rottenness within such a deep core of our own national history to admit his level of achievement. And I think he probably has a hard time admitting himself. I mean, who wants to be seen as the first black president rather than just as a good president? Of course he shies away from these issues in the same way that I don't want to just be known as an author who wrote about my evangelical background and grew beyond it. I want people to read my novels like Portofino and Baby Jack and Saving Grandma and say, hey, he's a good writer in his own right, not just because he has a story to tell about his life. He's a good writer. You want to be taken seriously on the level you have chosen to work in. So I just think a lot of these factors come into play, but I am betting that history will look back at this presidency as amazing and as pivotal and as a watershed, and not just because this was our first African-American president, but because he actually did do some things in this presidency which will go down in history as having genuinely, literally saved our country from real economic ruin from the path we were on. So the beginning of the healing between the division of the 1% and the 99%, the beginning of a racial healing, holding the line on our economy when it was sliding against all odds and tremendous opposition, getting us out of two terrible wars, gradually doing these things, I think will be seen in a much kinder light when this era has passed. And that's just my opinion. It's not worth more than that, but, you know, that is my opinion.
Well, we definitely appreciate it. Can we solve this whole thing?
We can. It's called time. And if you look at the arc between a slaveholding rapist who is one of our founders who wrote our Declaration of Independence and the fact that we now have a wonderful, upright, thoughtful, soft-spoken, lovely human being, no matter what else you think, sitting in the White House trying to govern compassionately, caring about the people, and giving us all a shot, we've come a long, long way. And I think as Americans, black, white, brown, or anyone else, we have something to be proud of. We have every black American who showed forbearance and didn't just burn it down to thank for allowing us to see this day instead of giving us the justice and retribution this society deserved. The mercy that we have experienced from our oppressed community, our foremost oppressed community, black America, will go down in history someday as what gave us time, in the same way that Nelson Mandela's reclamation of that society through reconciliation rather than terror has given that country a chance. Well, similarly, our African-American community has proved to be the foundation upon which all the goodwill has been built for, in an odd way, what it did not do in seeking the revenge we all justly deserved here. So Barack Obama is the reward for that, and we can build from that, and that's our future. And I believe in that, and I believe in the future, but there's no point in pretending that these problems have not come dragging in with us into this present, and we have to be aware of them and admit them, or we just can never get past them. And I think what's going on in Congress, as I talk about in my alternate article, but also lay out in my own reasons for departure from the religious right and the Republican Party in my book Crazy for God, I think, you know, points the way future, because to a better future. If you can look at what we're doing now that's wrong, you can get a clear vision of where we ought to go. If you keep pretending it's not happening and this is all just politics as usual, and if he was anybody else, he'd face the same thing, and deny that racism is playing a big part, I don't think we can get past square one.
That's real talk. We appreciate it. Frank Schaefer, how do we get a hold of you?
Well, various ways. If you want my book, you just go to Amazon, and Crazy for God and my other books are there. If you want to talk to me, you go to frankschaefer.com. That's FrankSchaefer.com, and click on contact, and I answer my email. And, you know, if you want to read this article, it's on Alternet right now on the front page. You just type in Alternet and go there.
There you have it. We want to thank you so much for taking time. We know we kept you over a little bit, but fascinating conversation and insight. Frank Schaefer is his name. Look for his article, America's White Male Problem, on Alternet. Check out his books, Crazy for God. And that's just the short title. It's a much longer one. Want to thank you for being on the show this afternoon.
It's a real privilege, and thanks for having me.
Public enemy.
What's the deal? What's your latest hit, brother?
Fear of a black planet.
What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
We have been told that we are living in a democracy. We have been told that we are in a system where there is equal opportunity for everyone. Tragically, we have been told a gigantic lie, and that lie has been told over and over and over and over again. We are living in a system of racism, white supremacy. It is not a system of equal opportunity. It is a system wherein, let me go to my blackboard. Can you all see this board, or can, I don't know if it can be seen. Sometimes I think the blackboard is my security blanket. But we have to, each and every one of us, we have to have it clearly in our heads that we are on a planet in which we have been told we are the minority. Let everyone in this audience put it in their brain computer once and for all. That's the first big lie. 1/10 of the people on this planet have skins that are white. Only 1/10. 9/10 of the people on this planet, the overwhelming majority, are black, brown, red, and yellow. We must put this in our brain, and even if you find yourself saying, as a minority, check yourself and say, wait a minute, I made a mistake. Because this big deception, training the vast and overwhelming majority of people to consider themselves a minority, is psychological warfare. It's to make the majority feel minuscule in terms of numbers. So repeat after me. The black, brown, red, and yellow people on this planet are the overwhelming majority people on planet Earth. Fine, class. Okay. The second gigantic lie is that something is wrong with the genetics of black people. 21 years ago, I debated Dr. William Shockley, the Nobel Prize laureate. He was then a professor at Stanford University. And those of you who are old enough like me, remember he was going around talking about black genetic inferiority and that black people should have themselves sterilized so that they will not keep on polluting the planet with our degraded genetic material. 21 years later, we have Dr. Charles Murray and the late Richard Herrnstein singing the same song. In fact, there has never been a period, certainly for the people in this area of the world, the black people, there has never been a point at which people who classify themselves as white did not think that they were genetically superior to people whose skins were black. My grandfather, Dr. Henry Clay Kress, who died in 1909, a short time ago, I had an opportunity to see some papers that were in an old trunk. And my grandfather had written, I never knew him in person. I only knew my grandmother used to say, your grandfather was a race man. That meant that he considered his identification with other black people to be a priority. But my grandfather had written, how dare anyone think they are superior based on their skin being white. You see, but this hype about black people being genetically inferior is a denial of reality and a projection. As a psychiatrist, this is what I mean, and I said this last week in the debate, that anybody who goes around saying, I'm superior, hey, did you hear? I'm superior. That person is not really feeling superior. I said superiority always speaks for itself. You never have to wave a banner. But in my attempt to understand what racism is all about, because I wanted to be a good psychiatric physician to black people primarily, because they didn't have all of the psychiatric physicians that they needed. And when I took histories on black patients and found that their problems, whether it was drugs or alcohol or depression or psychosis, were stemming from confrontation with this horrible destructive force in the environment that we call racism, I said, I got to understand what that really is all about. And so looking at this fact that, wait a minute, these people who put this big lie out that they're the majority are really the minority. And the second big lie that something was wrong with our genetics, but in reality, white skin. This is not Francis Wilson's genetics that I cooked up in my apartment. Skin whiteness is defined by white people themselves, but when they were talking about a white mouse or a white bunny rabbit, not themselves, that this is a genetic deficiency state. It is albinism. It is genetic recessive as opposed to being genetically dominant. So I put those two things together and said, I've got it. This is what racism is really all about. This tiny minority of people whose own scientists have said that white is a genetic deficiency state, and it is recessive, figured out after they ended up circumnavigating the globe. People of color had circumnavigated the globe long before that. But people whose skins were white did not circumnavigate the globe until starting in the 15th century. And when they found out that everybody on the planet was colored, every place they stopped. Every place those boats crash landed, it was some more colored people. And the colored people were receptive, kind, and fed these strangers. And they even allowed themselves to have sexual intercourse with the strangers. And the strangers found out, if they waited 9 months, that all of the children ended up looking like the colored mothers. And so they decided, we have a color problem. They didn't have to have a big genetics conference. They didn't even have the formal science of genetics at that point. But they found out that black plus white equals color. Brown plus white equals color. So-called red plus white equals color. Yellow plus white equals color. And it didn't take high-level intelligence, really, to conclude, what if these men of color got in boats and started going in the other direction? And they landed. And the lady said their ideal mate was tall, dark, and handsome. They realized that white could disappear. Are you with me?
Hey. running, but they got me on the run. Treat me like I had a gun. All I got is jeans and chromosomes. Consider me black to the bone. All I want is peace and love on this planet. Ain't how that God planned it.